Phyllis Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. She has authored many books on the Middle East and U.S. foreign policy, including Before and After, U.S. Foreign Policy and the War on Terrorism, Understanding the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, A Primer, Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN, and Challenging Empire. Bennis is co-founder of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, and she was a featured speaker at the Jewish Voice for Peace conference, which was held in Oakland on April 28th and 29th. Phyllis Bennis spoke in Santa Cruz on Monday, April 30th, 2007, on the subject of Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power.
Thank you all for coming, and a special thank you to the Nonviolence Center here in, that's not the formal name. The formal name is the Resource Center for Nonviolence, which you all know far better than I, and you know the extraordinary history and work of this center. So I'm very grateful to them, to Scott, to the others, for bringing me here and for encouraging all of you to be here. Because at the end of the day, the work of Challenging Empire goes on here. It doesn't go on the airplanes where I live. You know, it's interesting, this notion of empire is becoming a common term these days in ways that it really hasn't been until the last couple of years. I mean, yes, there are some right-wing forces that are actually out there saying, yes, we're an empire, get used to it. That was actually the name of some, I forget who, but some article a while ago was sort of, yes, we're an empire, that's a good thing, you know. On the other hand, partly because the depth of coverage of the war in Iraq, which is not the totality of this drive towards war and empire, but is by far the most important tip of the arrow, if you will, of this trajectory. Because so much of that, with one important exception, is being shown on television, we're becoming more aware of what our government's policies actually look like. The part that's not shown, of course, is the death. The death of American soldiers is not allowed to be shown, and the deaths of Iraqis is certainly not acknowledged or shown or mentioned or counted. As we know, the Pentagon doesn't do body counts. This is a given. But because of that, the question of what occupation looks like, what military occupation looks like, which for a country like ours, in which only a few, those now quite elderly people, mainly men, a few women, who fought in World War II and saw military occupation, either before or after the end of the war, most of the rest of the population of this vast country has no idea what military occupation looks like. We hear checkpoints, and people think, oh, it's like a toll booth. You drive by and have to show something. You know, that's, I think, the image that people have. So the notion of walls, which we're now seeing and reading about in Baghdad, the new wall around the Adhamiya neighborhood in Baghdad, which almost entirely surrounds that neighborhood. Now, keep in mind, this is something that was decided on by U.S. military forces, who then informed their Iraqi counterparts that this was the next stage of the surge, right? The surge, of course, being the other word for escalation. But they informed their Iraqi counterparts that we're here to protect the people of Adhamiya. Well, who are the people of Adhamiya? Adhamiya is a neighborhood of Baghdad, largely, although not entirely, Sunni in its composition, something that never mattered much before, but these days, of course, matters a great deal. In that context, the U.S. claim is we're doing this for the good, for the safety, for the security of the people of Adhamiya. And the people of Adhamiya say, excuse me, not so much. Because for them, it is, number one, exacerbating the tension between sectarian groups and sectarian neighborhoods. And number two, it is imprisoning them. Now, why is it that this is becoming such a common sight? It's because the U.S. has learned a great deal from their ally in Israel. Not only the apartheid wall in the West Bank, which we'll talk about in a bit, but the less known but just as devastating wall that surrounds Gaza. You know, so the notion of walling off communities into big prisons in which the inmates may have the right to run around the prison and do whatever they want, but don't have the right to leave the prison, where everyone entering or exiting the prison is subject to the control of another force. This is what occupation looks like. This is what the United States doesn't want us to see, but this is what their policy is based on. We hear about democracy. This is what democracy looks like. We are going to bring democracy to the Middle East. Now, why? It's interesting to look at this. You know, why is it that we talk about democracy so much, right? The beginning of the war, think back. I'm looking around the room. I'm seeing that most of you were old enough to remember the beginning of the run-up to the war in Iraq. Don't laugh. There's, you know, there's good meetings where you look around the room and nobody is old enough to remember that. That's a good thing. This is a challenge for all of us. I did an event in Denver, or not in Denver, somewhere in Colorado, a week or two ago, and it was they were thrilled at the turnout. It was, you know, 125 people, whatever it was, I don't know. It was great. But I was looking around the room, I'm seeing maybe, stretching, maybe there were 10 people younger than me. And I started with the challenge. I am way too old to be the 10th youngest person in this room. This is not acceptable, right? Just a hint. Now, but looking around the room, I see that most of you are old enough to have remembered the run-up to the war in Iraq. Democracy was not the reason we were given at the beginning. It was Saddam Hussein is making a new nuclear weapon. Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein has ties with Al-Qaeda. Saddam Hussein, it was always about him. It was not about them or the government or the army. It was him, right? Now, this is not an accident either. If you go back a few years, all those years of crippling economic sanctions that led to the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children, not to mention the old people, the pregnant women, the older children, et cetera, who died through those years, was justified because of him. The sanctions aren't aimed at the Iraqi people. The sanctions are aimed at him. As if Iraq was populated by 24 million Saddam Husseins. The children, they're going to grow up to be Saddam Hussein. So it's okay. If they die, they die. Madeleine Albright was the one who said it. Remember, this is not just about Republicans. This is a bipartisan consensus here. It was Madeleine Albright who said, we think the price is worth it, right? That's what this legacy of empire leads us to. So for the United States, there were reasons. The problem was all those reasons turned out to be provably false. You know, you could scour a country and not find the weapons of mass destruction. And the answer is sort of, oops, better find another excuse. You could find out that the uranium yellow cake from Niger never existed, that it was, you know, a quick Google search was going to tell you that it was a forgery because the dates and the names didn't match. You know, that didn't take rocket science. It took a Google search, for God's sakes. So that one didn't work. Then you had the aluminum tubes that could only be used for producing a nuclear weapon, et cetera, et cetera. Remember Colin Powell, the one who everybody believed at the United Nations, the mobile biological laboratories? They didn't exist either. Sorry, Colin. You know, you've been had. So all these things were proved to be false. So what do you do when you've given up, you know, on all those reasons? You come up with one where you can't prove the negative. Democratization. We're invading Iraq to bring democracy on the back of our tanks, right? Because who can prove that you're not, right? It's, you know, it's one of those things. It's a little harder to prove the non-existence of democratization than to prove the non-existence of non-existent things, right? So that's where we get to democracy. Then we have this great, the set of great examples. In the Iraqi example, you have the U.S. imposing how the elections are going to work, right? They get the UN to put a little bit of political cover on it, but basically it's a U.S. operation. They have several series of elections. And the incredible part, the moving part, is that you see in these elections how the people of Iraq are desperate for democracy. That part is absolutely real. People risked enormous risks, took enormous risks, that's it, took enormous risks to vote. When they stood up with their finger in the air with the blue ink, it was real. That wasn't propaganda. That part was real. And overwhelmingly, They voted for parties who claimed that the first thing they were going to do when they got elected was going to be to ask the U.S. troops to leave. Well, what a surprise. They get elected, they go to Baghdad, if they survive that long, and they suddenly realize that if the U.S. troops leave, the little modicum of security they have, which isn't much, half the parliament is still living in Amman, Jordan, not in Baghdad at all, because it's not safe, even in the green zone, but the little modicum of security they have is only because of the U.S. troops. The U.S. occupation is there to defend the U.S.-imposed government. It's not there to defend the people of Iraq. So what a surprise. The elected representatives suddenly realize, no, no, it's not time yet. We can't ask the U.S. to withdraw the troops. Not yet. Of course, we are a sovereign government. We are now asking the U.S. to stay. Oh, okay. So you invade a country, you overthrow the government, you destroy the social structure, all the security agencies are destroyed, the civil service is destroyed. You hold elections under your own terms to create a new government that you control, and then you get them to invite you to stay. That's real democracy, right? Look at the other example, recent, the elections in Palestine. The U.S. goes to the Palestinian Authority and says, look, you want support from the West, you hold elections. And the Palestinians say, we're in trouble here. We're having no success in negotiating with the Israelis, partly because of you people. We're in no position to do serious elections. And the U.S. says, frankly, we don't care. Do the elections. The Palestinians essentially throw up their hands and say, all right, we'll do elections. Now, unlike other situations in the region, Palestinian civil society is relatively well advanced. People are pretty well trained in what democracy looks like. So they, surprisingly enough, take it seriously. And they have parties and they run. And people are getting a little bit fed up with the combination of problems that has come out of their last elected government, dominated by one party, the Fatah party, that had dominated Palestinian politics for years and years and years. And the problem was, I was in Palestine just before the elections, and what people were telling me was, you know, we could deal with the corruption if they were succeeding. If they were gaining some effort towards ending the occupation, we'd put up with the corruption. On the other hand, if they were clean as a whistle and really trying honestly, but failing, we could deal with that too. But the combination of corruption and failure, it's too much. I ain't voting for them anymore. It was, you know, people had that sort of off-the-cuff kind of attitude. No one thought there were so many people saying that, that Hamas, which doesn't have the level of percentage that they won in the election, they have a lot of support, but not quite what they got in the election. They won overwhelmingly. Nobody thought that was going to happen. But you know what? You have an election, you take the consequences. That's what they faced. Everybody there, from President Carter to the European Union to all the international observers, plus the local observers, all said this election was free and fair. Now, I have a little bit of a problem with that because I'm not sure that any election held under conditions of military occupation can ever be free and fair. But given the limits of that framework, it was as free and fair as you were ever going to get. Not bad. Everybody agreed that the vote, the final decision, was a good, adequate, accurate reflection of how people really voted. There was no fraud involved. And all of a sudden, the response of everybody is, ay, 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 now what do we do? Hamas had said all along, we don't want the foreign ministry, we don't want the treasury, we want what we know. We know social welfare, education, and health. That's our expertise. Those are the ministries we're going to want, because everybody knew they were going to do pretty well. Nobody thought they were going to win outright. So that's what happened. The Palestinians, unlike some other countries I could name, decide to take seriously the results of elections and allow the people who really won the election to take office. What a concept. But what happens as a result is that you have a great excuse now for the U.S. to make official what had been the practice but unofficial before, which is to completely isolate the Palestinians, claiming to isolate only one party, but in fact imposing sanctions and boycotts that are devastating the population. Devastating the population. For all of the struggles that have failed to win an independent, viable Palestinian state, for all of the failed struggles for equal rights for Palestinians. Palestinians never faced starvation. Starvation is now a serious threat in Gaza. The level of absolute poverty is above 60% in Gaza. Between the West Bank and Gaza, it's close to 50%. Absolute poverty. This was never a factor in Palestinian life before. Education has largely shut down. Why? Because there are, just in the West Bank, more than 750 checkpoints, 500 permanent checkpoints and about 250 what are called flying checkpoints, meaning put up in a different place every day, that divide people from each other. And then there's the wall. Remember we talked about the wall in Atamiya? Well, there's a wall in Palestine. Those of you, I think, that are involved at all with the Peace Center know about the apartheid wall. Now, I use the term apartheid wall because people here know what apartheid means. The Israelis, funny enough, use the same term. They call it the separation wall. Separation means apartheid. It's the same word. That's what they call it, too. This is not a security barrier. That's what they use to call it in the U.S. press. What they call it is the separation barrier, separation wall. Because it's not separating Israelis from Palestinians. Even for people who believe that walls can bring security, the same people who believe that building a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border is somehow going to prevent desperate people looking for work from coming to this country. That's nonsense, too. But if you want to believe that, you do have the right to build a wall on your borders. The problem is, Israel didn't build a wall on its border. It has built a wall of which 80% of the length of it, and the length is 750 kilometers or more, three times or so the length of the Berlin Wall, and much higher and bigger. In its biggest parts, it's over 100 meters wide, this complex that is known as a wall, because it's two on each side, it's barbed wire fences, then a road that's covered with sand and raked every morning, then a trench, and in the middle of the trench is a cement wall, 24 feet high, with gun emplacements every, I think, 50 yards. That's the wall. Now, it's not like that everywhere. In some places, it's only a 24-foot-high cement wall. In some places, it's a metal fence, maybe only 18 feet high. So it varies. But it is a huge barrier that is not dividing Palestinians from Israelis, but Palestinians from each other and Palestinians from their land. So the wall goes way inside the West Bank, way to the east, and has now taken, snaked out a route that makes sure that all three of the major settlement blocks where 80 to 82% of the 220,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank live are all on the Israeli side. Right? And most important, the water. All the West Bank aquifers are now on the Israeli side, the west side, of the route of the wall. So the wall is now what some Palestinian officials, some Israeli officials, including the foreign minister, somebody tell me. You all know who I mean. The foreign minister of Israel has said that the route of the wall is to be the new political barrier, the new political border of what Israel's borders will finally look like. She admitted it. Now, other Israeli officials say that the wall is to be the demographic border between Israel and Palestine, the demographic border, that Palestinians will be on one side of the wall and Israelis on the other side of the wall. The problem is, in doing that, the Palestinians are left with only 46% of the West Bank, which is itself only 22% of historic Palestine. So 46% of 22%, we're talking about the entire Palestinian population being squeezed into 10% of their historic homeland. And they're supposed to be grateful. Because somebody will say, you're an independent state. Here's your passports, here's your postage stamps, here's your telephone code. It will be completely surrounded by Israeli territory because it will include the Jordan Valley, will become part of Israel. There will be no border between the Palestinian state and any Arab country. There will be Israeli military and settlers in between. The 220,000 West Bank settlers plus the 200,000 settlers in Arab East Jerusalem, which no one even acknowledges are settlers, their neighborhoods are neighborhoods, not settlements. They're not included in the list. They will all be part of Greater Israel. Now, what does all this have to do with us? Well, it's U.S. support for the Israeli occupation that enables that occupation to continue. What does that support look like? It starts with economic aid. Now, Americans like to believe we're a generous country. We give the largest amount of foreign aid of any country in the world. We also give the lowest percentage of foreign aid based on percentage of our GDP of any of the 22 wealthiest countries in the world. The lowest. Nothing to be proud of. Nothing to be proud of. But where does that money go? We like to think that it's going to vaccinations of children in Chad, building wells for clean water in Bangladesh, right? That's our image of what foreign aid is about. That it goes to poor people in the poorest countries. That's a good thing. Israel is the 17th wealthiest country in the world. Now, actually, there was a bit of a recession last year. They may have slipped. Maybe they're 20, 21. But they are wealthier than a number of countries that are members of the European Union. That's the country who gets 25% of our foreign aid. This year, the Foreign Military Assistance Fund is giving Israel $2.4 billion in military assistance out of a total of just over $5 billion. It's almost half, right? In the United Nations, it's the veto or the threat of a veto in the Security Council that prevents Israel from being held accountable for its myriad of violations of international law. That's what it involves us. That's what it means when we talk about protecting the Israeli occupation. Look at the question of nuclear weapons in the region. A huge challenge. What do we need in the region? We need a nuclear weapons-free zone throughout the Middle East. That's been on the agenda of the region for 25 years. What stands in the way? Israel's 200 to 400 high-density nuclear bombs at their manufacturing plant in Dimona, in the Negev, in the desert, which, because they are not a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, are not under international jurisdiction. There is no international inspection. Everyone in the world knows about them. It was finally admitted, interestingly, last December, after a generation of an Israeli policy of official ambiguity. It was called strategic ambiguity, meaning they would never confirm or deny the existence of what everybody knew existed. But in December, that changed because Ehud Olmert, the prime minister, never became clear whether it was a slip or whether it was deliberate, acknowledged that Israel has nuclear weapons. Does the U.S. do anything about this incredibly provocative and dangerous and destabilizing factor of Middle Eastern life? Apparently not. Nothing to say about it. Never on the agenda. Never acknowledge it. And yet they are preparing to go to war against Iran, which does not have a nuclear weapon, because someday in the future they might have the capacity, if they chose 10 years down the line, to create a single nuclear weapon that couldn't be used against anybody anyway, which they don't have today. Israel, on the other hand, has 200 to 400 high-density nuclear bombs, and among other things, Germany just gave them two new nuclear-powered submarines to use to launch them. Wasn't that a nice little gift? So, you know, the U.S. government, we should be clear, is not alone in this. They just take the lead and take more and have a greater obligation than anybody else. So this is the scenario that we're dealing with in the drive towards empire. We have dual occupations. We have the U.S. occupation of Iraq and the U.S.-backed Israeli occupation of Palestine. We have new threats rising against Iran. We have the massive instability. What is this all about? Well, if you go back, say, to 1967, you can see a consistent trajectory in U.S. policy. Hasn't really changed very much. Three pillars of U.S. policy: oil, Israel, and stability, military and economic stability. The three pillars. The problem is, if you think about it, you really can't have all three at the same time. If you're really good, you might be able to have two, but you can't have three. Think about it. If you, say, decide that you want to have absolute control of access to oil, so that you can act as the guarantor of oil for your allies like Germany, Japan, Italy. And you want to have stability, meaning you have to provide unchallengeable support to these Arab dictatorships and pseudo-democracies and absolute monarchies that call themselves U.S. allies in the region. You can have that, you can have the oil, but to do it, you've got to back away from Israel. Look at it a different way. If you want to have a warm and fuzzy embrace of Israel, and you want to control the oil, the price you're going to pay is stability, right? That's what we have right now. They're trying to have the Israeli and oil legs, and the price is massive instability, rising war, occupations, and the threat of a nuclear annihilation as a very real possibility, as a very real threat. Now, in saying that that set of policies has been consistent, I don't at all mean to say that there is no difference between the various administrations, et cetera, et cetera. There is a huge difference between the kind of reckless drive to empire that we're seeing today under the Bush administration and that has been underway even before 9/11, but with a vengeance since September 12th. The events that changed the world was not September 11th. September 11 was a huge crime against humanity, a humanitarian disaster, a crime of enormous proportions. But it did not threaten our country. It did not threaten our survival. It did not threaten our democracy. It did not threaten our standing in the world. Quite the contrary. You all remember, within hours after the attacks of 9/11, before Bush's plane had even landed, all around the world, mobilizations of support and human solidarity were taking shape. The French headline, Nous sommes tous Américains maintenant. We are all Americans now. The French, I mean, who would think? Well, that didn't change the world. What changed the world was September 12th, when George Bush announced, you are either with us or you are with the terrorists. And if you are not with us, we will treat you as if you are a terrorist. That threat is what transformed the world. That threat is what threatens to undermine our democracy. That threat is what has made us so much less safe in the world. I don't want to say that that policy is no different than the kind of prudent imperialism that characterized years of earlier administrations, Democrat and Republican. But neither do I want to say that I support those earlier versions of prudent imperialism. You know, I don't know, I won't speak for you. I spent the 8 years of the Clinton administration in the streets, protesting sanctions, protesting the bombing of Kosovo, protesting bombings all over the world, you know? So it's not a question of, that's what we want back. You know, we don't want this, we want that back. We want something different. We want an entirely new foreign policy that's based on justice, not a foreign policy that's based on the expansion of power and the control of resources, leading to the control of peoples. But it is something that has been a bipartisan, unified position. My friend Jimmy Carter, by far the best ex-president we have ever had. Yeah. Listen to what he said. This was today's San Francisco Chronicle. There are people in Washington who never intend to withdraw military forces from Iraq. And they're looking for 10, 20, 50 years in the future. The reason that we went into Iraq was to establish a permanent military base in the Gulf region. And I have never heard any of our leaders say that they would commit themselves to the Iraqi people that 10 years from now there will be no military bases of the United States in Iraq. That's President Carter as ex-president. But remember what President Carter said when he was president. In 1980, the beginning of the Carter Doctrine. He was the one who said, this is in the wake of the Iranian Revolution, the overthrow of the U.S. backing Shah of Iran, that the oil under the sands of the Persian Gulf is our oil. It is a strategic asset for the United States, and we will use whatever means necessary, including military force, to protect those assets. That was Jimmy Carter, the human rights president. So, you want to talk candidates today, Hillary Clinton, the Democrat, is the one who used the term indefinitely to describe how long U.S. troops will be in Iraq. Now, speaking of Democrats, let's look for a minute at the proposal that is now about to go to President Bush. And I'm glad to say that I think the Democrats are going to do it right and send it to him tomorrow on the fourth anniversary of the so-called mission accomplished speech. You all remember that speech.
Yeah.
Perfect timing. Today, on the eve of that speech, of course, is the 32nd anniversary of the liberation of Saigon, the end of the war in Vietnam, April 30th, 1975. And this is a moment of enormous anniversary significance, you know, for all those reasons. But what's actually in that resolution? This is a very dangerous thing. It's rather shocking, not surprising, but shocking, because what President Bush is about to veto is not a resolution that will call for all the troops to be brought home by October of 2008. It's not a resolution that requires that no troops be sent to Iraq who have not been adequately trained, thoroughly equipped, and rested at least 1 year between deployments. It's not a bill, a resolution, that says that the president does not have the right to unilaterally attack Iran. It's not a resolution that says that the oil of Iraq belongs to Iraq and not to the United States. It doesn't say any of those things. What it says is that beginning as early as this coming March and beginning no later than July of this year, and to end as a goal, not a requirement, by September of 2008, there should be no U.S. troops in Iraq, except. And then we list four categories of troops, which together constitute somewhere between 60 and 80,000 U.S. troops who will remain in Iraq, according to Hillary Clinton, indefinitely. The 120,000 U.S. paid mercenaries who back up the U.S. military, 47,000 of whom are armed, and the others are doing things like washing dishes and cooking and cleaning and driving trucks and delivering gasoline, the things that the privates and the sergeants would be doing in an ordinary army that wasn't half privatized. There's nothing about them, except for a small reference to 15% of the billions of dollars for contracts for these guys. 15% of it should be made conditional on the contractors meeting certain benchmarks that don't mean very much. So it could, at best, mean a 15% cut in the money for these 120,000 contractors. The language about Iran, stripped out altogether. The restrictions that, you all remember, Congressman Murtha, the great defender of the military, when he turns against the war, it transforms the understanding of the country that suddenly even the pro-war, pro-warrior, pro-military types are turning against the war. He's the one who creates this set of restrictions that use the Pentagon's own guidelines to say Congress is now telling the president, you may not send to Iraq any soldier who has not been completely trained in what her or his job is supposed to be, equipped with whatever they need, particularly things like body armor, small detail, and adequately rested with at least 1 year between deployments. What it says is the president must do all those things unless the president announces that he doesn't want to, and then he doesn't have to. That's literally all they have to do. The oil. The oil thing is a little trickier, but at the end of the day, not so different. All it says in the law is the Iraqis must pass an oil law, a new oil law. Okay, that sounds neutral enough, right? The problem is the oil law that's actually under discussion in the Iraqi parliament is one that was drafted at the behest and under the control of the U.S. occupation authority. And what it calls for is putting a huge component, virtually the entire Iraqi oil industry, in the hands of private oil companies, which, of course, will specially privilege U.S. oil company, oil privileges, although that's not written in, through something that are called production sharing agreements. Essentially, what the difference is, because this is something that no other country producing oil in the Middle East uses. The ordinary system is a national oil company. The government controls the oil, right? And the government contracts with oil companies to do specific things. So I'm Saudi Arabia, say. I'm Saudi Arabia's government. I sign a contract with Shell Oil to build enough wells to get the oil out of that field. And then it's up to Shell to figure out how to do it, but I still control the oil. I can tell Shell to leave when I want. I pay them through the nose. They do very nicely. But I control it. I hire Chevron to build a refinery in X place. I hire, you know, so that's what it is. They're hiring oil companies to do specific tasks. What the U.S. demanded of the Iraqi government is not that they hire oil companies to do the tasks, but that they sign agreements in which the overwhelming majority of the Iraqi oil itself is controlled by these oil companies under these production sharing agreements for as long as 30 years. So even though right now the oil companies are not prepared to necessarily invest huge amounts of equipment and stuff because it's not very safe, they've got the right for the next 30 years to pick and choose the time, the place, how, when, how much. And, oh, just by the way, that gives them a huge amount of influence in OPEC. So this is the oil part of what President Bush is now vetoing. So imagine the extremism of this. You know, this is like an insanity. So, okay, all of that is the empire side. Now let's talk about, let me just talk about one other thing, and then we'll get to the challenging side, because that's really the important part, right? The costs of war. The costs of war are being qualitatively lied about. We're hearing some of the costs. We're hearing, and it's maybe accurate, we still don't know for sure, but it's probably more or less accurate, the number of U.S. troops being killed. We are hearing about some of the U.S. troops that are coming back grievously wounded. We're hearing figures in the area of 22,000 to 25,000 U.S. troops coming back seriously injured. Well, I was in a meeting a couple days ago with Congressman Bob Filner, who's a terrific congressman from San Diego, was a freedom rider in 1961, did 3 months in prison in Mississippi that summer in the state penitentiary during the freedom rides. A very modest guy, doesn't talk about that very often. I've worked with him for years. I never knew that. I never knew he had been a freedom rider, you know. He's the chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee. So he's got good sources, right? Right from the so-called horse's mouth, from the Veterans Affairs bureaus. According to him, of the 700,000-plus U.S. soldiers that have now fought in Afghanistan, in Iraq, not in, that's separate from Afghanistan, just in Iraq, 200,000 of them have applied for some kind of medical assistance. 200,000. Now, what we're being told is something like 25,000 are injured. What are these other 175,000? Chopped liver? You know, this is insane. A lot of them are applying for help for post-traumatic stress disorder. They're apparently not being counted in the injuries. The injuries are counted as the ones you can see, and they are indeed horrific. Multiple amputations, blindness plus amputation, deafness plus brain damage, brain damage plus amputations, and horrific combinations. Now, that cost, that human cost, we won't even talk about the equivalent among Iraqi civilians who don't have the access to these extraordinary life-saving procedures that the U.S. military now does. We don't talk about it because we can't. We don't have the information. But if we talk about the U.S. soldiers like that, put aside the human cost, put aside the cost to their families, to their loved ones, to their friends, to their communities, and let's just look at the national cost. Joseph Stiglitz, the Harvard economist, recently did a study, this was about a year ago, that was based on the idea that the war was going to be ending this year. And he said if the war ends this year, the total cost, once you factor in lifetime care for what was then about less than 20,000 of these grievously injured soldiers, because remember, these are young, healthy men and women when they start out. You blow off their arms, you blow off their legs, blow up their brain, blow out their eyes. The rest of their body is still young and healthy. They could live 50 years as a blind quadriplegic with brain damage. Imagine what that's going to cost the medical care system of this country. No one factored that in. So he and a colleague at Harvard figured it out, and they came up with $1.4 trillion minimum. Jesus. Minimum. And that's based on the idea that the war is going to end this year. Now, in California alone, the tax bill so far, and this is as of last August, so it's a lot more now, was $42.2 billion. Imagine what you could do in California with $42-plus billion dollars. Education, childhood vaccinations, child insurance, health insurance, all those things. How many teachers, how many firefighters could you hire because all your firefighters are off being deployed in Iraq? You know, it's an astonishing cost. And then we look at Iraq and what our obligation is to Iraq. And here we come to the question of, so what should happen? How can you say, people say to me, how can you say, pull out all the troops? Are you saying cut and run? You can't. How can we cut and run? We owe something. And I'm always glad when people say that because it tells me that they are serious in understanding that we do owe an enormous debt to the people of Iraq. And we owe much more than just this war. We owe 12 years of sanctions worth of reparations. We owe the destruction of infrastructure in two wars and invasions. We owe reparations, we owe compensation, we owe real reconstruction, meaning money that goes to Iraqi companies, Iraqi workers, Iraqi architects to redesign Iraqi cities, not money going to Halliburton and Bechtel and etc. We owe all of that. We owe support for real international peacekeeping. But we can't make good on any of those things as long as we are imposing a military occupation on the people of Iraq. So pulling out the troops is only step one. It's not step last. You know, we heard from Colin Powell the model why we need the troops to stay is the Pottery Barn analogy. You remember this? Iraq is a cup. The U.S. troops are like the crazy glue. It doesn't work. The analogy doesn't hold. The analogy that holds is the bull in the china shop. What do you do when the bull gets loose in the china shop and breaks half the cups? You don't leave the bull in the china shop and ask the bull to fix the cups. You get the bull the hell out of the china shop and write a check for the damage. That's what we need to do as a starting point in Iraq. So you want a soundbite? There's your soundbite. How do we do that? That's the challenge that we face. And here, I think we're coming very close to a new old Europe moment. You remember the line from Rumsfeld about old Europe and new Europe? In the run-up to the war, somebody said, aren't you sort of worried that so many of our close allies think what we're doing is insane? And his dismissive answer was, and he did it like this, with a sweep of the hand, that's old Europe you're talking about. New Europe is with us. Well, new Europe was Poland. It was Slovenia. It was, my personal favorite, Moldova, who gave in to U.S. pressure and agreed to send 47 brave Moldovan soldiers to back up the Pentagon because the Pentagon said, we need you, which was absolutely true. They didn't need them militarily. But they sure as hell needed to be able to say, we have a coalition of 35 countries that are fighting with us. So the Moldovans send these 47 hapless soldiers. God knows what they did during their 12 months in Iraq. And even in Moldova with only 47 soldiers, there was enough pressure on the government that the government came back to Washington and said, you know, it's enough. We're pulling out our soldiers. And the U.S. sent a delegation to the capital of Moldova to beg them not to pull out their troops. So, no, this gets better. So Moldova compromised and said, all right, we're pulling out 35. We'll leave you 12. Unfortunately, 6 months ago, they pulled out the last 12, taking away my best laugh line, but nonetheless. I mean, this is the depths to which they are falling. We're left at the moment. It's Britain, it's Australia are the main ones. It's and the U.S., you know, it's like the white colonial countries that are still keeping their troops there. So one of the things that we have to keep in mind is our power as movements, as social movements, as a global peace movement. How many of you were in the streets on February 15th, 2003, the day the world said no to war, the whole room? See, this is what we can learn from. This book that I did, Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power, is grounded in that experience. And here's the lesson I think we have to learn from it. February 15th was an amazing day, right? It began in Antarctica, right? And In Antarctica, something historic happened. The entire population of a continent came out to participate in an anti-war protest. 47 people in two different scientific research stations, the McMurdo station and another one. And they came out, and in one of them they tramped out a peace sign in the snow. In the other one they held up signs saying, Antarctica says no to war. And they sent up their rescue helicopter to take pictures. It was fabulous. The whole population of a continent, right? That's the first piece of history. Then you have this demonstration. The world says no to war in 150 different languages, sweeping across the country. It starts in the South Pacific, goes through the islands, Australia, New Zealand, up through southern Asia, then up into northern Asia, and across into Europe, down through all of Africa, across the pond to Latin America, and finally, last, the furthest west, the United States. And by the end of the day, there's another historic first, the largest one-day protest in the history of humanity. And the Guinness Book of World Records says that between 12 and 14 million people took to the streets that day. It was an astonishing thing. So in New York, I'll tell you a little story what happened that morning. People are gathering in New York outside the United Nations. It's the coldest day of the year. It was so freezing. It was 18 degrees was the high, with this bitter wind off the East River. It was just freezing. And people have been gathering since 9:30 in the morning. The demonstration, the rally point is right near the UN, and it stretches up First Avenue way further than you can see. You can see, it starts at 45th Street. You can see more or less till about 70th Street. It went way beyond that. There were 500,000 people there. There were another 250,000 people on the west side of the city who weren't even allowed by the police to get close enough to hear the rally. It was an amazing thing. That same morning, just as people are gathering, a small group of us go into the UN through the so-called frozen zone, which wasn't only cold, but it was iced off by police. The police called it the frozen zone. Took us through the frozen zone under police escort to meet with Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the United Nations. And it's a small delegation, just four or five people, led by Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And that's why we got the meeting with Kofi Annan, because no one says no to Bishop Tutu. And we go upstairs to the 38th floor, and the Secretary General is sitting at the table with his staff, and we are sitting on the other side. And Bishop Tutu begins, and he says to the Secretary General, "We are here today on behalf of the people who are marching in 665 cities all around the world. And we're here to tell you that those people marching in all those cities, we claim the United Nations as our own. We claim it in the name of the Global Mobilization for Peace." And you saw Kofi Annan look away and say, well, I won't say it on tape, but you can imagine what he said. He was not happy. Let's put it that way. Here's a man who was under more pressure than anyone else in the world at that day. The U.S. was desperately trying to get him to come on board their war, to give it the imprimatur of the United Nations, to use his bully pulpit to say, yes, this war is legal. And he was resisting that pressure. And here comes his friends pushing him harder in the other direction to say, you better not do this because the UN is ours. It's not only yours. Mm-hmm. 3 hours later, after we had put on 16 more layers of clothes and gone back outside into the bitter cold, backstage, somebody gets a call on their cell phone. So, I don't know from who. Somebody who writes down the two lines and brings it over to the organizers. And they look at it and say, what do we do? Do we say this? Do we not say this? We better tell people this. This could be important. Phyllis, you do it. You go out on stage and you do it. So I go out on stage. I had already spoken, but I go out to read this thing to 500,000 people. And it was a two-line quote from Associated Press that had just broken over the wires, Dateline United Nations. And it said, "Stung by the outpouring of global criticism, the U.S. and Britain today announced they were withdrawing their resolution from the Security Council. They were no longer going to ask the UN to endorse the war." It was an astonishing moment. Here were people all around the world saying no, and here was the response. Now, 2 days later, the New York Times does something it almost never does. It tells the truth on the front page above the fold in an article that says, once again, there are two superpowers in the world, the United States and global public opinion. It was huge. And, of course, all of us that were writing and speaking about the war at the time we grab the line because it's too delicious. How can you not use that? You know, we are the second superpower. I wanted to name my book The Second Superpower. Everybody in my office said, what are you, nuts? Nobody knows what that means. Said, all right. But I liked it, right? But what I think the Times missed, there was a nuance that they missed. What made us a superpower on that day was not only that it was the largest demonstration in history. Demonstrations have come and gone, will come again. Demonstrations alone don't make history. What made us a superpower on that day and in the days before and after was that there were enough people mobilized from enough countries around the world that governments were forced to do the right thing in huge numbers. Not because they wanted to, but because they suddenly were going to have to pay too high a price to do the wrong thing. It was suddenly cheaper politically to do the right thing than the wrong thing. And when it's cheaper to do the right thing, governments will do it, right? So you had this extraordinary moment when you have not only the wealthy, powerful countries, Germany, France, Russia, saying this U.S. war for empire is not in our interests. And let's be clear, this is not about strategic alliances and shared commitments. Jacques Chirac was not against the war because he was worried about Iraqi children. Vladimir Putin was not against the war because he was concerned about human rights violations. These were leaders of countries and parliaments of countries and governments of countries who had their own opportunist reasons to oppose the war. But for whatever bad reasons they had, they were forced to do the right thing by this massive outpouring of pressure from people and from other governments. And then suddenly, you had enough governments saying no that the UN was suddenly able to do what its charter says it's supposed to do, but it almost never gets to do, to stand up to the scourge of war. So in the Security Council, you have what became known as the uncommitted six, poor countries, dependent countries, countries that rely on aid from the United States. Guinea, Cameroon, Pakistan, Angola, Chile, Mexico. These are not countries that would ordinarily go head to head with the U.S. And the pressures on them are enormous. Chile, for instance. It's now, let's see, this is 2003, early 2003. They've had 13 years since the overthrow of the dictatorship. 7 of those years, they have spent negotiating for a free trade agreement with the United States. Now, it's a terrible agreement. We had spent the 7 years opposing it. But nonetheless, the Chilean government was very committed to this free trade agreement. They had finished the negotiations. Everybody had agreed. All that had to happen was the Senate had to ratify. The U.S. envoys came to the Chilean ambassador and said, if you don't sign on in the United Nations, we're not ratifying this. We're not going to bring it to the Senate. That's it. That's your choice. And yet they stood firm. The Mexican ambassador was told, if you don't sign on, no more negotiations over border issues. The Mexican president had been elected on the basis of he was going to solve the border crisis. And yet they stood firm. Guinea and Cameroon both were getting money from something called the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, this very terrible aid and trade development act in the U.S., AGOA, which gives a little pittance of aid, not much anyway. But there's a line in it that apparently is quite standard in a lot of aid agreements that nobody ever pays any attention to. But what it said was, no country receiving aid under this law may do anything that undermines U.S. foreign policy interests. Now, it didn't say what are the U.S. foreign policy interests, but you could be pretty sure that voting against the U.S. on war in Iraq in the Security Council in February of 2003 was probably going to qualify. And yet, Guinea and Cameroon stood firm. So you had this extraordinary mobilization that enabled the General Assembly then to pass a resolution against the war, the Security Council to refuse to pass the U.S.-British resolution supporting the war, the Secretary General, late but eventually, saying the war is illegal. This was huge. And in my view, it was that three-part challenge, the people, the governments, and the UN, that together made us a superpower. Now, it didn't last. It was a blink of an eye, historically. It was 8 months, from around the fall of 2002 through May of 2003, when the U.S. and the British imposed enough discipline, as they put it, pressure is the real word, on the Security Council to force a resolution that, quote, recognized the U.S.-British occupation. you had that moment of what the world could look like if there was this kind of mobilized public opinion forcing governments to do the right thing, allowing the UN to take the lead. That's what we have to create. Our work now has to be aimed at recreating that. That means that remembering that we are part of a global peace movement. June 9th and 10th have been identified in a global call to action. The world says no to Israeli occupation. In the U.S., the focus is going to be in Washington on June 10th, a massive march and rally. Important, not because it's going to be the biggest march ever had in Washington, it's not, but it's going to be the first big tens of thousands of people come to Washington specifically to protest U.S. support for the Israeli occupation. We're going to bring with us 100,000 signatures, and you all need to be helping us with the postcards that are out there. Most people from California won't be able to come to Washington. Maybe a few of you will. We hope so. Bring a sign if you do saying we're from California. But everybody can sign on to the postcards. It's a very simple call. The call is just two things. Stop U.S. economic, diplomatic, military, and corporate support for the Israeli occupation. And build a new U.S. policy based on ending occupation and equal rights for all. How simple is that? Should be something everybody could support. So getting 100,000 signatures should be easy. We should get 1,000 from Santa Cruz alone. We'll get you more postcards. I want to stop so that we can open this up. But I want to end with just one other story, if you will, because this is something that I think is a serious challenge that we face. We talk a lot about empire and this, the question of the bases that are being built all around the world, 735 bases around the world, permanent bases. You know, this notion that U.S. troops are going to be in Iraq indefinitely, that's what this article is about. It's about the bases. Isn't that part of why we invaded in the first place? Absolutely. It was about oil. It was about the expansion of power through military bases. It is a drive towards empire. But there's a really big difference between this empire and earlier empires. There's lots of differences in form. Earlier ones paid more attention to control of territory. Ours is more about controlling resources. But none of that is really that important. What's really important, I think, what's really different about our empire is that while all empires collapse, what makes them collapse could be very different. Every empire in the past has been brought down from outside with great violence and fire and the deaths of huge parts of the population of the empire's center. We have a different option. As citizens of empire, we still have civil rights. Our civil rights are being shredded. We are losing our civil rights. But we still have more civil rights than the citizens of any empire that ever existed in the past. And it means we have a greater obligation. Now, those of us who are native-born citizens, who are white, who are not Muslim, we still have the most civil rights. People who are Muslims in our society, citizens or not, have fewer rights. Not because it's written in law that way, but that's the real world. People who are not native-born citizens have fewer rights than those of us who are native-born citizens. They are at greater risk. So those of us who have the greatest rights, those of us who are white, who are native-born citizens, who are not Muslims, we have an extra responsibility to fight for those who have fewer rights. And we have the possibility of bringing down an empire for the first time, nonviolently, using the tools of nonviolence, the tools of democracy, without having to kill the people who populate the center of the empire. We can do that in a whole different way and reclaim our country. So that in the future, when people look back at this empire, we won't think about it the way we think about the Roman Empire, where Tacitus, for instance, the great Roman writer who followed the Roman legions at various points as they laid waste to half the world, one time climbed a hill after a battle and looked out at what he saw below. And he said, "The Romans brought devastation, but they called it peace." That is what our government has done around the world. If we want to be remembered differently, we have that obligation as the citizens of empire to bring it down while reclaiming our country. Thank you.
And that was Phyllis Binnis speaking on Monday, April 30th, 2007, on the subject of Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. Phyllis Binnis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. She is also the co-founder of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation and the author of a number of books, including Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. She was also a featured speaker at the Jewish Voice for Peace Conference in Oakland in April of 2007. And now we're going to hear the question and answer portion of Phyllis's talk.
The question was, there's a growing sense that in Washington, public opinion doesn't matter, that whatever the public opinion, they can, you know, they can do what they want. I really disagree with that. If we look back, start with this earlier period, and then I'll talk about now. In that period of challenging the empire, in that period of the run-up to the war in Iraq, the events of February 15th, the global mobilization, did not ultimately prevent the war. It was clear by then, I think, to most of us, that they were going to wage that war regardless of anything that happened, regardless of a coalition of the coerced or non-coalition, regardless of public opinion. That was true. But that mobilization of people and governments and the UN did something very, very important. It made clear to the world, uncontrovertibly, that this invasion was illegal. And it turns out that despite all the propaganda to the contrary, Americans in particular, and people around the world, much more so, really do care about international law. It turns out that Americans don't want to live in a rogue state. They want their government to be accountable to the same international conventions that govern other countries. And that makes it much harder to go to war in the future. The fact of that mobilization is making the job of those pushing for a U.S. attack on Iran far more difficult. Now, is it ultimately going to make sure it's prevented? I can't promise that. But it is certainly making the possibility much less likely. In the immediate period, what we're seeing sent to Bush right now is absolutely a reflection of public opinion. The elections of 2006... everybody in Washington knows and talks about as a referendum on the war, very clearly. Now, it's absolutely true that what the Democrats have done so far is not cut all the funds, bring all the troops home, what we want. Repeat after me, Congress is not the peace movement, right? I didn't mean that literally. You people obey way too quickly. Be careful of that. But, you know, it's one of those things. Congress is not the peace movement. They are people, some of them bought off, some of them good people, lots of them somewhere in between, in an institution designed to operate within a very constrained box and to compromise down from there. That's their job. Our job is to hold to principle. Our job is to say, we will not support any resolution, any supplemental bill that continues to fund the war. This bill starts with, let's give Bush $100 billion. So we're not in favor of it. It's good that they raised all these questions about restrictions on the troops, sending, requiring certain conditions, setting dates. That's all good. But at the end of the day, we're still not going to support it because it still gives Bush $100 billion. Our job is not to compromise, so that it strengthens those of our friends in Congress who want to compromise less. This was step one in what's going to be a very long, incredibly painful and frustrating process of getting Congress to ultimately hold this administration to account by cutting the funds. It's not going to happen in the next 5 votes, I promise you that. It may over 10 votes, maybe, but I doubt it. This is going to be a very long process, and we have to have a very nuanced understanding that on the one hand, we do not compromise on our principle. Our principle is not one more death, not one more dollar, let alone not one more $100 billion. But we also have to understand that when even some of our closest friends in Congress put up a good fight and then collapse and vote the wrong way anyway, we criticize them for it, we hold them accountable. Maybe the next time around, if some of the offices are being occupied, they don't get exempt the way they did the last time. But it doesn't make them our enemy. That's what we have to understand. It doesn't make them our enemy, and we're going to have to deal with them for the future, and we're going to have to support them and recognize them as our friends within this very limited institution within which they work. Because why?
Congress is not the peace.
Thank you. See, now you get it, right? So that's, you know, that's what we're faced with here. Yeah, Stephen.
Well, one thing that's been driving me to the wall is all these Democrats who are now saying, if I knew what, now what, if I knew then what I knew now, I wouldn't have voted for the war, when you know darn well, you and me, among others, were telling them exactly what would happen. We were telling them that there was, you know, Iraq was not a military threat, and we were on Talk of the Nation, MSNBC. We were fairly prominent, both of us, and of course, Scott Ritter, who knew it all more than either of us, was and knew more about this than anybody was there. I mean, a lot of people were saying all this. Do you, I mean, what is your take about the Dianne Feinsteins, the John Kerrys, the Tom Harkins, you know, the people, John Edwards, people who really should have known better, who made these outrageous statements? Mm-hmm. Do they really believe it? Do they figure, well, it's probably wrong, we win such a big victory, okay, we won't be on the right side? What, lying or just stupid?
I don't know whether they were lying, whether they were stupid. I think they are mostly opportunists. And I'm glad that they're saying it now. Even if they're lying about, you know, I didn't know or whatever, they're responding to public opinion. It comes back to this same question. Public opinion is forcing them to say, I was rooked. No politician wants to admit that. That's a big admission. You know, I was had. I was lied to. You can say, well, it's Bush's fault for lying to me. But it's your fault for listening, you know. So it's not an easy thing. It's an admission. And the only reason they're making that admission is because of us. Because we're demanding, because we knew better. And our movement knew better. And the people of this country knew and know better. That's what they're responding to. So I don't think there's much to be gained by yelling at them and saying, oh, you're lying, or oh, you're an opportunist, or oh, you're whatever. All we say is, great, now what are we going to do about it? You know, that's step one. Now, what's going to be your step two? There's no point in us holding ourselves up as some great angels. They weren't listening to us. They weren't hearing us. They weren't reading us. Yeah, we were on TV once in a while. That doesn't mean they ever heard us. None of that's true. So maybe it's true that they believed it. They wanted to believe it. Certainly the demonization of Saddam Hussein and the demonization of Iraq had been strong enough for 13 years that it wouldn't be surprising if people really did believe that this was a regime capable of anything. You know, that's not surprising. Members of Congress don't have a lot of separate access to information any more than we do. They also don't have as much time as we do, those of us who concentrate on this issue. They're concentrating on a million issues. So did they know and they're lying about it? Were they just stupid? I don't know. But I don't think it's important. I think what's important is, great, now you get it. Now what do we do to end it? That's, you know, that's the point. All this stuff about Hillary Clinton's got to be forced to apologize. Why? What if she apologizes? So what? What does that get us? She still believes the same thing she believes, which is U.S. troops will be in Iraq indefinitely. So whether she apologizes or not for what she did back then is a far less consequence than what she's saying about what she wants to do now. So I just don't see that as a very important argument. Yeah, in the back. Yeah. The question was about the Jewish Voice for Peace conference that just finished in Oakland. The whole raison d'etre of Jewish Voice for Peace focuses on ending occupation. They're an active member of the U.S. campaign to end Israeli occupation. They're doing a lot of work to mobilize for the June 10th and June 11th demonstrations. It's a demonstration, march, rally, and then the next day a lobby day. They had lots of good discussion. I don't know if they had a meeting the day before, an all-day meeting of their national board, I guess. The conference part was more just presentations and discussion that were quite fascinating. I mean, very nuanced discussion about, you know, everything from one state versus two states to, does it make any sense for us to be debating one state, two states, because after all, we don't live there. You know, so the discussion was all over the place and very, very good. It was all taped and it's going to be up on their website, I understand. So people can take a look at that. Yeah. The question is, if a two-state solution was became possible and Palestinians got a sovereign state in the West Bank and Gaza, is it possible to have a viable state that's divided between two pieces of territory? In my view, that's probably the 10th most difficult problem. That's, in a sense, the least of it. Right. The real question is, let's come back to what is the two states we're talking about, especially when we're talking about the West Bank and Jerusalem. Are we talking about a state in the West Bank, which is what Israel would love to give, 46% of the land divided into more than 70 segregable cantons, right, with a new concept that Ariel Sharon developed called transportation contiguity, meaning if you can drive there from one to the other, even if you have to go underground in a tunnel, over a river, across the bridge, to grandmother's house, whatever you had to do, if you can drive from one place to another, you call it contiguous, even when it's divided. So 70 separate, non-contiguous pieces of territory grouped into three major blocks is to become the Palestinian state. That's the Israeli version. That's a Palestinian sovereign state. Sovereign. Sovereign means you have passports, you have an ambassador in the United Nations, you have a telephone access code all your own, you have an internet abbreviation. Those are the things of sovereignty, right? It doesn't make it viable. A viable Palestinian state under a two-state solution, as is true according to the proposal of the Arab League that was reproposed just in the last month or so, but first came out in 2002, would be a Palestinian state made up of all of the Palestinian territories occupied in 1967, meaning the entire West Bank, the entire Gaza Strip, and the entire Arab East Jerusalem. No exceptions. Now, that presents a number of problems, starting with 420,000 Israeli settlers in Arab East Jerusalem and in the occupied West Bank. Three settlement blocks, which are huge cities, like the city of Ma'ale Adumim. We hear settlement, right? We think either tent cities or we think the top of a hill, a beleaguered little group of trailers and a couple of water barrels, you know, the sort of heroic pioneers holding back the hordes trying to storm the hill. Ma'ale Adumim is a city of 40,000 people. Well, no, I don't think they're up to 40,000. I think they're still about 37,000. They've put a bunch of new apartments up for sale. It has two shopping centers, a college and a university, and a flight school. It has a huge industrial zone spewing huge toxic waste down onto the Palestinian side rather than the Israeli side. It has beautiful green lawns with sprinklers that run practically around the clock, two swimming pools, plus private swimming pools in lots of the houses, great schools, clean air, beautiful sky, houses. It looks like a sort of West Los Angeles suburb, you know, Spanish-style red tile roofs, whitewashed buildings. It's gorgeous. What's not to like? And the people who live there tend to be very liberal. They vote Labor. They're not ideologues. They're not either religious or nationalist extremists. They're yuppie settlers. They're there because the government pays them. The government puts huge amounts of money into these subsidies, into subsidizing electricity, water, buying houses, cheap mortgages, the land. Everything is subsidized by the Israeli government. They pay for the buses to take the kids to the best schools, et cetera, et cetera. They buy separated roads so that you never see a Palestinian. And these are people who have said their town emblem is the Picasso Dove of Peace. They don't see that as a you know, ironic something or other. They see themselves that way. Many of them have said that they're prepared to move back to Israel if they're properly compensated. Now, how do you properly compensate for a city of 40,000 people with industry and stores and schools and universities and colleges and flight schools? And, you know, it boggles the mind. Now, you can say they have the option to remain in their homes as citizens of the new Palestinian state. Some of them might. I think I know them both. You know, this is not a viable option in most cases. But if we're going to talk about a two-state solution, that's what we're talking about. All this talk that suddenly Condoleezza Rice and everybody is suddenly very interested in the Arab League position. You know, they're talking about, the Arab League position talks about not only ending the resistance, but full normalization of Israel in the region. Trade relations, tourism, open borders, integration of Israel into the Middle East. Fabulous. what they're leaving out is the predecessor to that, the precursor, the requirement is complete Israeli withdrawal back to the 67 borders and a just solution to the refugee crisis based on Resolution 194 that allows the right of return. They don't talk about that part. That's a good idea. That's a real good idea. You think it would be very popular, given where the refugees now live? You know, this is the challenge that we face. This is why so many people are saying, because of facts on the ground, a two-state solution is no longer a viable option. The building and expansion of settlements have made it impossible. And therefore, the only solution is a one-state solution with a struggle for equal rights. Now, Palestinians and Israelis both do not see that in majorities. It's a tiny minority of both peoples who see that. It tends to be more in the international arena that the one-state solution is being talked about a lot more than people inside. People inside the Palestinian territory still want an independent state of their own. But they want it to be viable. They don't want to have borders completely surrounded by Israeli troops. They want to have borders against Jordan, the way their country was designed to be, right? So this is where we are. And the question is, what role will the United States play?
That was Phyllis Binnis speaking in Santa Cruz, California on Monday, April 30th, 2007, on the subject of Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power. Phyllis Binnis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. She has authored many books on the Middle East and U.S. foreign policy, including Before and After, U.S. Foreign Policy and the War on Terrorism, Understanding the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, a Primer, Challenging Empire, and Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. Binnis is co-founder of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, and she was a featured speaker at the Jewish Voice for Peace Conference, which was held in Oakland in April of 2007. She has worked to end the U.S. war and occupation in Iraq and supports a just and comprehensive peace based on an end to Israeli occupation of Palestine. She works closely with the United for Peace and Justice Anti-War Coalition and has played an active role in the growing global peace movement. For more information about Phyllis Binnis' books, go to interlinkbooks.com. That's interlinkbooks.com. For more information on the Institute for Policy Studies, go to ips-dc.org. And for more information on the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation, visit intheoccupation.org.